Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Opinion, Texas View. Abbott must provide cure to voting in a pandemic. The point, voters are scared, and this transcends partisanship. Governor Greg Abbott would be remiss if he fails to call a special legislative session to address myriad concerns threatening the primary runoffs and November general election. Anything short of legislative action on how elections will be carried out during a pandemic will result in legal challenges that will continue past Election Day. Executive orders and guidance memos from state election officials are simply not enough to ensure a smooth election process in what the New York Times is calling the biggest voting rights battle since the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The Texas Democratic Party has already filed 2 election lawsuits challenging the state's absentee ballot regulations. The first was filed last month in state court. The most recent lawsuit was filed in San Antonio federal court. Recently, the state's director of elections sent elections administrators in all 254 counties guidance on dealing with absentee mail-in ballots, telling the administrators they could be less rigid in making this practice available. On the surface, this sounds promising, but upon deeper reflection, it's not enough. This guidance is neither a mandate, nor does it create new policy, the Express News reports. It also creates the potential for patchwork regulations, as some counties may broaden vote by mail while others might not. How is that reasonable for statewide elections? To be clear, there is value in expanding mail-in voting, especially during a public health crisis. We support this effort. No voter should be disenfranchised out of concern for catching COVID-19. That's why the state, under Abbott's leadership, needs to craft a bipartisan plan. If more mail balloting is going to be encouraged, as it should be, there needs to be a legislative directive ensuring everyone is eligible for that option. Texas has one of the strictest laws on mail balloting in the country, limiting access to voters 65 or older, people who have a disability or illness, those who will be out of the country during the election period, or those who are confined in jail but still eligible to vote. As a result, only about 7% of Texans cast mail ballots. Only 8 states conduct elections entirely by mail or are in the process of transitioning to mail voting only. They all spent years making the move. A sudden increase in mail voting would be overwhelming for many elections departments. Even large urban centers such as Bexar County could experience difficulties. Consider the local numbers. During the March primaries in Bexar County, 23,000 ballots were mailed out and 18,000 ballots were returned. County Elections Administrator Jackie Callanan said her department can readily handle 60,000 mailed ballots in-house and up to 120,000 ballots with current staffing. But that's if she can get more space to ensure social distancing guidelines are met. Elections administrators also need time to order supplies if the state is going to ease mail balloting regulations. Public education campaigns need to launch to educate the public on voting by mail procedures to ensure all pages of a multi-page ballot are returned and those ballots are returned in a timely manner. extension of deadlines for mail ballots must be considered. Under current election law, ballots cast locally cannot be counted if they arrive more than one day after the election. Military members and expatriates are allowed extra time. There is growing concern about the timely arrival of ballots cast in countries that have curtailed much of their international mail due to limited flights available to transport the mail. Recently, President Donald Trump voiced strong opposition to expanding mail voting. "Republicans should fight very hard when it comes to statewide mail-in voting," he tweeted. "Democrats are clamoring for it. Tremendous potential for voter fraud, and for whatever reason, doesn't work out well for Republicans." But the reality is voters are scared, and this transcends partisanship. Voters don't want to compromise their health by voting in person, and voter fraud is often a red herring. If the state is going to expand access to mail ballots, and it should, it needs to do it right. The details need to be laid out in black and white. We can't afford a patchwork of local rules on voting by mail. Abbott needs to lead a bipartisan effort to ensure all Texans have access to mail-in ballots and all counties follow identical rules on Election Day. This is about democracy and health, not partisanship. San Antonio Express News. Death notices for Friday, April 24th. Anthony Gaines Bullard. Anthony Gaines Bullard, 67, of Odessa, died Wednesday, April 22nd. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. April 27th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa. Alice Loreen Johnson. Alice Loreen Johnson, 78, died Wednesday, April 22nd. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. John Mark Billings. John Mark Billings, 61, died Tuesday, April 21st. Services will be scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Betty Waters. Betty Waters, 83, died Tuesday, April 21st in Midland. Services are pending with Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa.
Hello, this is April, reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, April 19, 2020. Viewpoints. The time is now. Bold actions are needed on oil and gas. Mike Conaway, Texas's 11th Congressional District. The energy sector is quite literally the lifeline of the Permian Basin and directly impacts every single business and person in our community. Many of us who were born and raised in the Permian Basin are no strangers to the boom and bust cycles inherent with the oil and gas industry. But this downturn is different. Not only are our West Texas producers caught in the crossfire of an oil price war between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Russia, which flooded the market with cheap crude, causing oil prices to collapse overnight, they are also dealing with the disastrous market effects from the worst health crisis in modern memory caused by the fallout of COVID-19. Almost overnight, this double whammy has left thousands of our friends and neighbors jobless, businesses shuttered, and our entire way of life threatened like never before. There is no easy way to sugarcoat it. We are in the fight for our lives, and the situation is dire. Bold actions are needed, and I am engaging directly with the foreign leaders at the heart of the oil market collapse. I am actively working with the administration and congressional leadership to call attention to this crisis, and I am in near constant communication with local oil producers. it is imperative that we leave no stone unturned in the fight for our livelihoods. Last week, I sent a letter directly to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, urging him to take immediate action to bring stability, not further volatility, to global crude oil markets. This letter was signed by Republican Whip Steve Scalise and 46 other members of Congress on the House Energy Action Team, HEAT. Shortly after the HEAT letter was sent, and thanks to the voices in the Permian, President Trump announced that a historic deal had been reached with the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries plus Russia, OPEC plus. The president's leadership and swift action to intervene in the global market manipulation resulted in OPEC plus members agreeing to cut production by over 10% in an effort to stabilize our world supply and put an end to global market manipulation. His intervention was key to the success of the agreement, and we will continue our work with him and his administration to make sure the agreement is seen to fruition. Ahead of this announcement, in an effort to further ensure our voices were heard during these critical negotiations, my colleague and fellow Texan Chip Roy and I coordinated a conference call between oil and gas producers in the Permian Basin and senior Trump administration officials within the Department of Energy. Our industry leaders were able to voice their concerns and provide on-the-ground reports of the impact that the global oil market is having on our small to medium-sized producers in Texas. Calls like these, and the many other efforts of our Permian producers, have been integral in shaping national policy by communicating the dire reality of our situation and the need for urgent action. Furthermore, on April 1, I joined a letter with House Republican Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican California, and more than 20 other members of Congress to the Interior Secretary, requesting that the department reduce or eliminate oil and gas royalty payments on federal lands. This action would provide relief to our fossil fuel industry and allow production to continue. Finally, in Congress, I am leading a bipartisan effort to overturn Speaker Nancy Pelosi's demand to remove the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPR, funding from the Phase 3 Coronavirus Relief Package, CARES Act, and ensure that any additional relief legislation supports the Department of Energy's efforts to fill the SPR with Permian oil. As we continue to battle through these trying times, know that I am down in the trenches with you. While we have a hard road ahead, we should take comfort in the fact that our communities and industries have survived the cyclical nature of the oil business before, and we always come back stronger in the end. I believe through bold action at home and abroad, we can remain hopeful that we will reclaim America's energy dominance and preserve our West Texas way of life for generations to come. ECISD gets it right with Do No Harm philosophy. Heidi Kirk. I recently read an article about ECISD's current conversation regarding promotion to the next grade level. In the article, ECISD used the term "do no harm" to describe their philosophy about how the end of this school year should go. To ECISD, that term means students' grades will go no lower than what they had on the last day of face-to-face instruction, March 5. The article didn't specify their grading tactics during this unprecedented time, but it gave me the heart of their decision-making process. Do no harm. This is exactly what should be happening in Midland, and while I want to believe that's true, I can't confirm it based on information already provided to the community during the public updates or by what I am experiencing as a parent. You see, I've already received an email about my children being in danger of receiving no credit for a class they were passing when we went to break. It's their best subject, and my kids normally see the STAR test in that subject matter. One of those children is already stressed about doing her work remotely. She is working, but she feels overwhelmed. Her mental health is just as important as her academic growth, especially during this time. This learning environment is new to these kids, and none of them signed up for it. I've seen a lot of parents comment about the amount of work. which varies from teacher to teacher and school to school. I have spoken with a lot of people, online and during previous lunch pickups at a local elementary school, who are terrified about trying to work with their kids at home. I have even noticed comments from educators who are struggling to balance teaching their students with teaching their own children at home. It's important to note the district has done a lot to provide for our students during this time as well. We have students who picked up devices to use at home. We have Wi-Fi buses dispatched to community locations and schools with enhanced Wi-Fi to help kids who do not have internet access to their assignments. The district has provided food, counseling, and tech support, too. This is not an easy situation, and the district has worked hard to do what is necessary for kids. With that said, we also need to talk about what this new environment looks like for the students and their families. First, estimates based on the amount of time a student needs to complete assignments are just that, estimates. Some children need longer than others, which varies depending on their love for and mastery of the subject matter. For example, if you have me do work for an English class at home, I'll be done fairly quickly. But science will likely take longer, because I don't enjoy it in the same way. Every person, student, is different in that aspect. It's important to remember this as we look at how best to finish this school year. One child's 30 minutes of work may be another child's 3 hours worth. Second, not all students have the support necessary to complete this instruction online and at home. The suggestion I have seen to help students in this situation is to send them to summer school, with virtual summer school being an option. If the students don't have that support now, it's unlikely they will have it over the summer. I hope we are preparing for ways to support advancement of skills during the next school year because it will be needed. Third, have we really analyzed what these scenarios really look like at home? Psychologically, people are struggling to adjust to their current circumstances, which look different for everyone. Academically, many parents do not feel equipped to teach their children what is necessary, which adds to the psychological stress they are already experiencing. Physically, some of these families are still struggling to provide food and shelter. We may be in a hiatus for evictions and foreclosures, but that money is still due and payable every month. It won't be forgiven when this is over. Let's take the example of the common conversation I see online. Two parents with 3 children and limited access to devices and internet. One parent is working, and all 3 kids require support to do work. If each child has the estimated 3 to 4 hours of work per day, and only one child can work on the computer at a time, that could be 9 to 12 hours of support from the parents every day. But one of those children also struggles with a vision issue, and reading takes twice as long as it does for the average student in that age group. And another child has an anxiety disorder that makes asking for help difficult and causes emotional breakdowns when he falls behind. Now we can add the fact that the parent at home dropped out of high school and the idea of working with their children on subjects they personally struggled with is causing psychological stress, all while adjusting to being at home 24/7 with a shortage of toilet paper, beans, and milk. We also can't forget about the parent who is still working and worried about bringing home COVID-19 to the family, or about the impending layoff because oil prices are low, or the business is about to shut down due to quarantine. Did I forget to mention the family doesn't have internet at home either? So 9 to 12 hours of being at a school or parked at a bus for the kids to work online isn't actually likely to happen either. I understand the need to monitor progress. Students and parents need to know where more support is needed to help our kids be ready for next year. But I don't agree with retaining students right now because of difficulty in working remotely during this crisis. While my example in the previous paragraph may seem outrageous to the family who has multiple computers, high-speed internet, and a pantry full of everything they need, it's reality to some degree or another for many people in our community. And some of us fall into one or more of those situations or are one step away from it, even though the people around us may not ever know. A better example of what should be happening right now is what one of my children's teachers did this past week. He emailed me to let me know my daughter was falling behind, and he asked how she was doing. In that conversation, I was able to share her struggles, ask him for advice on helping her, and provide insight into what my daughter might need from both of us. There was no threat of not advancing to the next grade or losing credit for the course. I understand what caused the other teacher to warn me of my children's lack of progress. She is probably overwhelmed, too, and wants to be sure she has done her due diligence in notifying parents about progress. And, for the record, I think my children have wonderful teachers who are doing their best to navigate this new environment. I am not upset with any of them, and am grateful for the work they are doing now and have done all year long. This is a new frontier for teachers, students, and parents. I absolutely want to know if my child is on target to mastery, but I know that isn't based on how much work is completed right now. I think my children's teachers know that too. Actually, I'm confident my children's teachers already know which students are on track to mastery and knew it before the quarantine. Mastery is based on understanding of the subject matter. It should have been evident before spring break which children were not on track. What is really needed right now isn't the threat of not promoting. It is the need to support those students who are not on track, to continue to instruct those who are, and to convince the parents they will survive. Up until now, the district has done an excellent job overall at providing that support to families. I hope this new grading plan will do the same. But the community will need more explanation of what it actually means for their students before we have the potential to see that support from it. Use the system, provide us feedback, but tell us what it really means for our students. Feedback about where my child is with regard to what they need to know at the next level is important to me. Penalizing children because they don't fit the new required learning model is not something to take lightly either. Will MISD also do no harm to students through this new system? Or do we need to worry what will happen to our kids when this quarantine is all said and done? Disruption like we are experiencing has the potential to help us make a better system for our students. The question is whether it will or not. And I think, do no harm, is a good motto to abide by.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, April 19th, 2020. Energy lawyer. Pro-rationing order would prompt litigation. By Mella McEwen. MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Texas' three railroad commissioners are weighing the pros and cons of mandating statewide production cuts, known as pro-rationing, after hearing 10 hours of testimony on Tuesday. The agency and the industry are seeking ways to navigate the economic turmoil of sub-$20 oil prices amid rising crude supplies and a historic drop in demand caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Kaes Van 't Hoff, Chief Financial Officer of Diamondback Energy, testified that if pro-rationing is enacted, his company will take its activity to zero right away. Scott Sheffield, President and Chief Executive Officer of Pioneer Natural Resources, told commissioners in his testimony that unless they took action, much of the industry would disappear. Should the commissioners vote to implement statewide pro-rationing, likely would lead to litigation over the commission's authority to enact such an order, according to Charlie Sartain, Dallas-based attorney and leader of Gray Reed's Energy Litigation Group. If a pro-rationing order comes to pass, you could see litigation by two groups, those philosophically in favor of free market mechanisms over those imposed by the government, and those whose production cuts by the order are greater than by the market, he told the Reporter Telegram by email. You could also see environmental groups intervening in order to push their agenda that flaring constitutes waste under the other provisions of the TNRC. For example, 85.046 sub A sub 4 permitting any natural gas well to burn wastefully and should be curtailed. That said, I don't foresee the Commission acting on the proposal. Here is why. waste is, among other things, under production of oil in excess of transportation or market facilities or reasonable market demand. And the Commission may determine when excess production exists or is imminent and ascertain the reasonable market demand. Given the political and economic philosophies of the commissioners, they are unlikely to be inclined to impose pro-rationing by government order. If they were to go down that road, evidence of the volume of production in excess of transportation or market facilities or reasonable market demand would be required. No such evidence has been presented. If there are additional hearings, countervailing evidence would be presented showing that market forces are resulting in production cuts. Under the TNRC 85.046, reasonable market demand of one pool cannot be discriminated against in favor of another pool. The Commission would have to determine the reasonable market demand for each field, not statewide. That would be a complex undertaking and is not what Pioneer and Parsley are asking for. Sartain said that, in her questions, Commissioner Christy Craddock seemed to focus on the process and procedures of pro-rationing, noting that the Commission hadn't employed market demand pro-rationing since the early 1970s and no longer has the expertise to implement such a regulatory regime. James Mann, an attorney for the Texas Pipeline Association and former Railroad Commission staff member, told commissioners that pro-rationing today would be very different from when it was first implemented in the 1930s. Back then, the goal of pro-rationing was to ensure that every producer had a fair chance to produce their oil and natural gas and to ensure everyone had an equal slice of the pie. Today, the goal would be to choose who got a slice of the pie. Sartain said that while Craddock focused on the process and procedures, Commission Chair Wayne Christian asked questions about the practical effects of the proposal, wondering if, for example, Texas should act unilaterally or only if other producing states follow suit. Commissioner Ryan Sitton tried to determine if the current supply-demand imbalance fit the statutory definition of waste. There are disagreements among the participants, Sartain wrote. For example, XTO and Oventiv argued that the current supply-demand imbalance is not waste as defined by the statute, while Pioneer and Parsley Energy asserted that it is. While he did not watch the entire 10-plus hours of testimony, Sartain reviewed approximately 120 comments and observed that 51 of the comments supporting pro-rationing, while 59 were opposed, and 12 comments were neutral. Also, some speakers were not clear on their position. A surprise was the support among producers and other industry players for implementation of tighter rules on flaring, including calls for a reduction in flaring permits, especially in the Permian Basin. Such a concern was a universal theme among environmental organizations.
This is Trish reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, April 21st, 2020. This is from the opinion page, Guest View, Plan Needed to Keep Voters Safe and Elections on Schedule, from the Dallas Morning News. An unsettling legal fight is emerging that threatens the state's ability to choose competent and effective leaders at a time when we need them the most. A state district judge has ruled that all Texans afraid of contracting coronavirus through in-person voting should be allowed to vote by mail. In short, State District Judge Tim Sulak sided with Texas Democrats, who argued the disability clause in the state's election code allows it. Texas Republicans have long been reluctant to expand mail-in voting, citing fraud concerns. So it came as no surprise then that no sooner than the judge's gavel came down, the GOP Attorney General Ken Paxton disputed that ruling and signaled his office will appeal. The provision applies to the truly sick and disabled, he contends. Sadly, we've become accustomed to these bipartisan fights, but this time we're urging all our state officials to put the overriding priority on these goals. Keeping voters safe and ensuring there are no more delays for the important local, state, and national elections in July and November. It's April, so there's plenty of time for our state leaders to find a way to conduct fair and honest elections that don't make voters choose between their health and doing their civic duty. It's clear that we will be dealing with this virus for some time, and now's the time to come up with contingency plans for how we're going to deal with our elections. This newspaper has pointed out several times that this pandemic has shown that it is critical to have strong leaders making decisions that affect our lives. We must find a way to increase the number of Texans who can participate in electing them. There are some hopeful signs that we can accomplish this. Many counties, including Dallas, now allow voters to cast ballots at any location during early voting, for example. Texas could extend the early voting period to reduce crowding at the polls. And maybe every voter could be issued a protective mask. Other ideas, including expanding mail-in balloting, should be on the table. Almost half of the states in this country allow voters to request mail-in ballots for any reason without giving an excuse. Washington, Oregon, and Colorado conduct full elections by mail, sending ballots to every registered voter. Of course, protections are required to safeguard against fraud, and safeguards are required to ensure public confidence. But states that have expanded mail-in voting don't report widespread abuses. The key here is to develop an effective plan, roll it out publicly, and test drive it so it doesn't falter. History shows us that some of the most innovative ideas can emerge when our society is in the midst of the most chaotic times. Coronavirus has tested that notion in ways we could not have imagined. These upcoming elections are too important. State leaders can't just shoot down ideas. They've got time to deliver a plan to get these elections right. Important election dates. July 6th, early voting starts for primary runoffs. July 14th, new primary runoff election day. November 3rd, general election and new date for municipal elections. From the Dallas Morning News.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, April 20th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. This article is entitled, "Texas is Running Out of Money to Pay Unemployment," by Claire Proctor, Texas Tribune. Texas is running out of money to pay the growing number of people lining up for unemployment relief, economic experts say. If you just lost your job, don't worry. State officials say you'll get your check. But if you're an employer, you might see taxes hike in the future because the state will have to borrow federal money to plug the hole. More than 1 million Texans lost their jobs and filed claims from March 15th to April 11th as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. The Texas Workforce Commission has paid out more than $400 million in benefits so far and is expected to pay hundreds of millions more based on the mounting claims filed. Unemployment benefits are paid out of the state's Unemployment Insurance Compensation Trust Fund, which is funded by unemployment insurance taxes and payroll taxes paid by businesses. Texas is among the states in the worst position to continue to pay out claims, according to a report by the Tax Foundation released this month. Jared Walsack, director of the foundation's state tax policy, told the Texas Tribune that based on the most recent unemployment data released Thursday morning, the state will only be able to pay out about 3 weeks of additional benefits. Only four states had unemployment trusts in weaker shape than Texas, according to the report, with California and New York ranked the two worst off in the nation. The Wall Street Journal also reported last month that Texas was among only six states that had less than 6 months of payouts available for unemployment claims, falling far short of being, quote, recession ready, unquote, a designation that requires at least 12 months' worth of benefits. Cisco Gomez, Texas Workforce Commission spokesman, said the agency estimates it won't run out of money until May or early June, depending on the level and timing of unemployment benefit payments. but he stressed that everyone who qualifies for unemployment insurance will receive benefits. If the state runs out of funding and borrows money from the federal government in the form of a Title 12 loan, businesses could see a very substantial increase in their unemployment taxes if the state can't pay back the federal loan within 2 years, Walsack said. Typically, this system makes sense, Walsack said. Businesses pay higher tax rates if they have a history of laying off workers and are incentivized with lower tax burdens to retain employees. But because Governor Greg Abbott's order that all workers providing non-essential services stay home to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus, businesses large and small have had to cut employees' hours, furlough workers, or lay off staffers. Unemployment is inevitable, Walsack said, so it doesn't make sense to punish businesses by having them pay a higher unemployment insurance premium tax rate. Walsack said the state is woefully unprepared to pay off debt from the federal loan. The implications will be very serious for the state's finances, he said. Texas's unpreparedness comes from past economic downturns, Walsack said. Unfortunately, Texas has been backward-looking, paying off the debt of the Great Recession rather than looking forward to the next crisis, he said. It becomes a vicious cycle. During the recession just over a decade ago, the Texas Workforce Commission borrowed about $1.8 billion from the federal government, Gomez said. To cover the loan, the commission had to raise employer taxes, he added. As part of the federal coronavirus relief bill, Title 12 loans are interest-free through the end of this year. But Walsack said Texas will almost certainly still be paying off federal loans next year when interest will start accruing. The health of a state's unemployment insurance compensation trust fund is formed by the tax rate and generosity of benefits, Walsack said. Historically, Texas has had lower unemployment insurance tax rates and fairly generous benefit payments, Walsack said, which don't work together very well. Stephen Craig, an economics professor at the University of Houston, said this will cause future businesses to have to pay for current unemployment costs if tax rates increase. This kind of situation shows why you do have to be prepared for the future, Craig said. You don't want to tax future firms for benefits they aren't getting. If taxes had been higher in the past, more funding would be saved. But having too high of unemployment insurance taxes in the past would have put a damper on the economy, Craig said. So policymakers are looking to find the tax rate that's just right. Disclosure: The University of Houston has been a financial supporter of the Texas Tribune, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that is funded in part by donations from members, foundations, and corporate sponsors. Financial supporters play no role in Tribune's journalism. This article is called Retailers to Begin Gradual Return with Limits by Maria Halkias, Dallas Morning News. Retail is almost back in business in Texas. The doors aren't open yet, but stores that have been temporarily closed in Texas since mid-March can legally offer remote shopping starting Friday. Employees are required to wear face coverings, work at least 6 feet apart, and must be screened for symptoms before entering the building. Governor Greg Abbott on Friday outlined a first step to someday opening closed stores with a warning to follow the precautions already in place to minimize the spread of the coronavirus. Abbott branded the limited operations, quote, retail to go, unquote. It's basically delivery and curbside pickup, services that grocery retailers and department stores and other retailers have offered as part of their e-commerce operations in recent years. Apparel, shoes, accessories, beauty, jewelry, home goods, gifts, toys, and books were deemed non-essential as sheltering-in-place orders were designed to keep people at home. Much of the industry tiptoed around the rules, trying to keep a little revenue coming in behind their temporarily closed doors. The pandemic has been difficult for big and small retailers that don't sell essential items such as food, pet supplies, and medicine. It was also confusing to employees and customers who assumed that certain stores would or wouldn't be open. Office supply, electronics, and hardware stores were open because the government said they support working and schooling from home. Businesses complained that Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Home Depot, Costco, HEB, and other essential retailers could be open and sell non-essential merchandise while they were forced to cease all operations. Major U.S. retailers never really stopped selling online, and enforcement was nearly impossible when officials warned that only stores that sell essential goods could stay open. Online shopping has been the only source of revenue for closed stores. It's also a way to phase in the reopening of the economy. Shelter-in-place rules nationwide displayed a lack of understanding about how retail works in 2020. Much fulfillment of online orders is done from stores, not warehouses. This article is entitled, Dallas Airport Leaders: Virus Could Change Airports as 9/11 Did, by Kyle Arnold, Dallas Morning News. It's rare during recent weeks to see more than three or four people waiting in TSA screening lines at DFW International Airport, even with half of the station shut down. Most stores and restaurants are closed, and passengers are distantly spaced in seats around gates. DFW Airport CEO Sean Donohue hasn't seen anything like it since the days following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, which transformed the air travel industry from a leisurely experience into a national security operation. Amid social distancing and the threat of COVID-19, North Texas's major commercial airports, DFW and Dallas Love Field, are trying to find a way to get passengers back into airports and feeling good about traveling again once the pandemic subsides. At DFW, Donohue said changes at airports could be similar to those instituted after 2001, although it's still unclear how it would all come about. "We are looking at making as many things as we can touchless," said Donohue, who was an operations executive at United Airlines during the 2001 attacks. "It's going to be as simple as touchless soap dispensers in bathrooms. But a lot of the technology, things we have been looking at for the past few years, are going to go from theory to necessity." Only 90,000 passengers traveled from U.S. airports Wednesday, according to the TSA, a 96% drop from a year ago. "Who's going to want to sit in a middle seat right now?" asked Brian Del Monte, an airline industry analyst with the Aviation Agency in Minnesota. "The government's $50 billion in grants and loans may not be enough to get all carriers through the year and into the next without bankruptcies," he said. "And even then, there will be far fewer flights and fewer destinations until the economy fully recovers and COVID-19 is completely gone. It means there will be permanent capacity reductions," he said. DFW and Dallas Love Field combined are receiving more than $350 million in federal stimulus money through the congressional aid package passed last month. The money is supposed to go to pay for employees' salaries and debt for projects that airports won't have the operating funds to pay for. Leaders at both airports say they had plenty of operating money even without the stimulus grants because passenger and concession growth has been strong for more than a decade. DFW has more than 500 days of operating cash on hand, Donohue said. Dallas Love Field, which is owned by the city of Dallas, has about 250 days worth of cash. Both airports are trying desperately to weather the upcoming dip in passengers without massive layoffs or tenant vacancies. DFW said it won't lay off any of its 2,100 employees. Dallas Love Field hasn't had any layoffs either, but has reduced contracts and let go of temporary workers. Dallas Love Field is trying to cut about $20 million out of its $150 million annual budget said Mark Dubner, Love Field's director of aviation. Like DFW, Love Field has eliminated rent guarantees for tenants, and the airport is allowing them to pay just a percent of sales in the coming months. We are all grappling with expenses because we assume the revenue losses will carry at least 6 months, Dubner said. Long-term plans for the airports could change, too. American Airlines said Thursday that it would seek to reduce seasonal service to a handful of locations, including summer routes to Anchorage, Alaska, Kalispell, Montana, and Hawaii, until it ends its quarantine for out-of-state travelers. DFW had been a beneficiary of much of America's growth as it pushed to more than 900 flights a day in 2019. It will clearly be far lower for the remainder of 2020. There will likely be a big push in technology and cleaning in the coming months and years to make people comfortable with flying and being in crowded airports such as DFW, Donahue said. Facial recognition for baggage checks, security lines, and boarding could also become faster as a way to eliminate human-to-human contact. The upcoming Terminal F, a $3.5 billion project, could be delayed a few months or several years, Donahue said. There eventually will be a need for a new terminal, but it might be more like 7 or 12 years, and it could open in phases to give airlines, particularly American, more time to grow, he said. We have been looking at a lot of scenarios for how long it will take for people to come back and fly again, Donahue said.
Hello, this is Michael. As we near the end of our program for this Friday, April 24th, I'll be reading Dr. Keith Roach's and Dear Abby's columns from the Odessa American. MMR Booster and Shingles Vaccine. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, last October, my doctor suggested that I receive the MMR vaccine booster shot after an immunity test showed that I needed it. I was born in 1962. Is it safe for me to get the shingles vaccine now, less than a year after my MMR booster? I was told that one cannot receive two live vaccines too close together. Answer. Many vaccines are supposed to be given at the same time, including live vaccines. However, the likelihood of a reaction, especially muscle aches and elevated temperature, goes up when multiple vaccines are given together. When possible, it's reasonable to wait a while between vaccines in older people. Even though it is not a live vaccine, the new shingles vaccine has somewhat higher likelihood of making people feel unwell for a day or so. I prefer to give that one separately. Some patients have asked for it on Friday, so they have the weekend in case they get a reaction. The MMR, by the way, is a combination of three live weakened virus strains together, and it is a very well-tolerated vaccine in most adults as well as children. They were given separately decades ago, but now only come in the U.S. as a combined vaccine. Dear Abby, woman questions why man won't pull trigger on divorce. I am a 39-year-old woman recently separated. I have been seeing a 45-year-old man who is also separated but not divorced from his wife. We have been a couple for about a year. I don't understand why he doesn't get a divorce. When his wife, who has also been seeing someone for more than a year, found out we were seeing each other, it got ugly. She came to our place of employment. Her ex and I work in the same place, different departments, and tried to get me fired. Fortunately, she was unsuccessful, and she tried to get physical. She told me she is his wife. She told him as well. And said she tells him what to do, and she owns him. At that point, I had to stop seeing him. After a month apart, I became really depressed, and we hooked back up. We go out and enjoy each other's company, and the sex is amazing. He told me he has never felt like this with any other woman, nor has he ever introduced anyone to his daughter, who loves me dearly. We are taking things slower and more carefully, but I am falling in love. He tells me he misses me when we are intimate and how grateful he is for me. But it isn't enough. I want more, but I don't want to scare him away. Is this a dead end? Should I be patient or should I just walk away? It's complicated in the East. Dear Complicated, I have to wonder why, after a year, you are not in the process of being divorced. You also need some straight answers about what keeps this man under his wife's thumb. The woman appears to have serious mental issues. Is the reason financial, emotional? Once you know, you will have a better idea of what to do. I am troubled by the fact that your boyfriend's wife is so volatile. As it stands, that woman is controlling not only him, but also you, and that's not healthy. Dear Abby, I was raised in a very strict household. At 19, I left home and never looked back. Today, I am 54, divorced, and own my own home. My mother passed away, and my father moved in with me a few months ago because he didn't like living alone. I have had to make several adjustments to accommodate him. The problem is, he's extremely traditional and refuses to change his way of thinking where I am concerned. In his eyes, I am still his child, and I should respect and abide by his rules. I have a boyfriend who lives several miles away. When he visits, I would like him to spend the night with me in my room. My dad demands, that my boyfriend sleep on the couch or in the guest bedroom. He has informed me that it is my choice, but if I don't abide by his wishes, demands, he will refuse to talk with my boyfriend, which undoubtedly will cause stress in my relationship. I have told my father that I am a grown woman and that I refuse to give up my freedom to accommodate him in this area. After all, this is my home. How should I handle this? All grown up in Arkansas. Dear All Grown, if you knuckle under dear old dad's demands, you are making a big mistake. Sit him down, remind him that you are no longer a little girl, and if he cannot accept that you are an adult with needs of your own and be respectful to your boyfriend, he will no longer be welcome to live under your roof. Do not try to placate him, or you will be living the rest of your father's life in a second childhood, and it won't be a happy one.
Jacqueline Bigger Stars. Note, Bigger Stars is based on the degree of your sun at birth. The sign name is simply a label astrologers put on a set of degrees for convenience. For best results, readers should refer to the dates following each sign. A baby born today has a sun and moon in Taurus. Happy birthday for Friday, April 24, 2020. Nurturing and protective, you make sure all your loved ones are healthy. You spend this year being creative or enjoying solitary hobbies such as music or art. You ensure finances are stable. If single, you especially enjoy exchanging messages with a new prospect who has suddenly caught your eye. If attached, resist the temptation to give directions all the time. You married an independent person who gives you a lot of happiness. Capricorn speaks their mind. The stars show the kind of day you'll have. 5 dynamic, 4 positive, 3 average, 2 so-so, 1 difficult. Aries, March 21 through April 19. 4 stars. It's a wonderful day to boost earning power through experimenting with creative ideas. Devotion to your finances promises deep satisfaction in the long run. A partner decides to upset the status quo. Insist upon balance and respect. Tonight, pay bills first. Taurus, April 20 through May 20. 4 stars. A cycle of frantic activity and competition reaches its end. Take some time to revel in the peace and quiet of nature. Let go of that which you have fought a partner over. It is finished. A child needs extra time. Tonight, just as you like. Gemini, May 21 through June 20. 5 stars. Replenish your vitality by taking time to rest and regroup. Become focused on a small project. You can complete it with aplomb by day's end. Write a dream journal. You will be surprised at how much wisdom you glean from it. Tonight, early Betty buys. Cancer, June 21 through July 22. 4 stars. Disputes with a partner can be resolved through the meditation of mutual friends. Groups are lucky for you today, including an organization that plans to ask you to become a member. Write down your highest wishes and goals. Tonight, catch up with friends online. Leo, July 23 through August 22. 3 stars. Suggestions that you resist at first can prove to be valuable in the end. A close companion has multiple projects in process. Discussion will dispel confusion. You will have an opportunity to influence the course of action. Tonight, network with higher-ups. Virgo, August 23 through September 22. 3 stars. Purchase books and consider joining an online class in your interested study. Friends can seem quite opinionated. Help a comrade direct anger in a constructive way. Choose new associates with discretion today. Tonight, watch a documentary on a foreign country. Libra, September 23 through October 22. 2 stars. It can be a little difficult to concentrate today. Follow a schedule combined with positive affirmations. Ask others to rephrase if the meaning of their words is not clear. This is especially true if you are asking about instructions. Tonight, an early bedtime. Scorpio, October 23 through November 21. 5 stars. Even when you are with another, you can feel alone. It is part and parcel of being born a Scorpio. But today, an existing relationship moves to a new level, and this makes you very happy. In this new time, happiness is needed. Tonight, date night. Sagittarius, November 22 through December 21. 3 stars. Seek creative ways to enjoy leisure hours at home without jeopardizing your freedom. Do not argue about finances with a child or other loved ones. Resolve to enjoy all that you already have in your home and in your domestic routine. Tonight, slow down. Capricorn, December 22 through January 19. 4 stars. An email or phone call could mark the beginning of an intriguing new romance. Today brings an important development. For once in many years, throw caution to the wind and declare yourself to be open to love. Tonight, no obsessing. Aquarius, January 20 through February 18. 5 stars. Psychic bonds between parents and children strengthen. Wry, subtle humor will appeal. Work on home-related projects together, with lavish praise given to every individual. You will finish something by tonight of which you will all be very proud. Tonight, celebrate. Pisces, February 19 through March 20. 2 stars. Use humor and good listening skills today. A loved one may be, quite frankly, freaking out from the pandemic scenario, and you are needed to be the calm one. Your cleverness and eloquence enable you to succeed. Tonight, catch up with a brother or sister. Born today, writer Anthony Trollope, 1815, actress Shirley MacLaine, 1934, singer Barbara Streisand, 1942.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.